Warriors, peacekeepers, welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 7, Chapter 8. Count Ilya Rostov had resigned the position of Marshal of the Nobility because it involved him in too much expense, but still his affairs did not improve. Natasha and Nicholas often noticed their parents conferring together anxiously and privately, and heard suggestions of selling the fine ancestral Rostov house and estate near Moscow. It was not necessary to entertain so freely as when the Count had been Marshal, and life at Otradnoye was quieter than in former years, but still the enormous house and its lodges were full of people, and more than 20 sat down to table every day. These were all their own people who had settled down in the house almost as members of the family, or persons who were, it seemed, obliged to live in the Count's house. Such were Dimler, the musician and his wife, Vogel, the dancing master and his family, Belova, an old maiden lady, an inmate of the house, and many others, such as Petya's tutors, the girl's former governess, and other people who simply found it preferable and more advantageous to live in the Count's house than at home. They had not as many visitors as before, but the old habits of life, without which the Count and Countess could not conceive of existence, remained unchanged. There was still the hunting establishment which Nicholas had even enlarged, the same 50 horses and 15 grooms in the stables, the same expensive presents and dinner parties to the whole district on name days. There were still the Count's games of whist and Boston, at which, spreading out his cards so that everyone could see them, he let himself be plundered of hundreds of rubles every day by neighbours who looked upon an opportunity to play a rubber with Count Rostov as a most profitable source of income. The Count moved in his affairs as in a huge net, trying not to believe that he was entangled, but becoming more and more so at every step, and feeling too feeble to break the meshes or to set to work carefully and patiently to disentangle them. The Countess, with her loving heart, felt that her children were being ruined, that it was not the Count's fault, for he could not help being what he was, that, though he tried to hide it, he himself suffered from the consciousness of his own and his children's ruin, and she tried to find means of remedying the position. From her feminine point of view, she could see only one solution, namely, for Nicholas to marry a rich heiress. She felt this to be their last hope, and that if Nicholas refused the match she had found for him, she would have to abandon the hope of ever getting matters right. This match was Julie Karagina, the daughter of excellent and virtuous parents, a girl the Rostovs had known from childhood, and who had now become a wealthy heiress through the death of the last of her brothers. The Countess had written direct to Julie's mother in Moscow, suggesting a marriage between their children, and had received a favourable answer from her. Karagina had replied that for her part, she was agreeable, and everything would depend on her daughter's inclination. She invited Nicholas to come to Moscow. Several times the Countess, with tears in her eyes, told her son that now that both her daughters were settled, her only wish was to see him married. She said she could lie down in her grave peacefully if that were accomplished. Then she told him that she knew of a splendid girl, and tried to discover what he thought about marriage. At other times she praised Julie to him, and advised him to go to Moscow during the holidays to amuse himself. Nicholas guessed what his mother's remarks were leading to, and during one of these conversations induced her to speak quite frankly. She told him that her only hope of getting their affairs disentangled now lay in marrying Julie Karagina. "But, Mama, suppose I loved a girl who has no fortune. Would you expect me to sacrifice my feelings and my honour for the sake of money?" he asked his mother, not realizing the cruelty of his question, and only wishing to show his noble-mindedness. No, you have not understood me, said his mother, not knowing how to justify herself. You have not understood me, Nikolenka. It is your happiness I wish for, she added, feeling that she was telling an untruth, and was becoming entangled. She began to cry. Mama, don't cry, only tell me that you wish it, and you know I will give my life anything to put you at ease, said Nicholas. I would sacrifice anything for you, even my feelings. But the Countess did not want the question put like that. She did not want a sacrifice from her son. She herself wished to make a sacrifice for him. No, you have not understood me. Don't let us talk about it, she replied, wiping away her tears. Maybe I do love a poor girl, said Nicholas to himself. Am I to sacrifice my feelings and my honour for money? I wonder how Mama could speak so to me. Because Sonya is poor, I must not love her, he thought. Must not respond to her faithful, devoted love. Yet I should certainly be happier with her than with some doll like Julie. I can always sacrifice my feelings for my family's welfare, he said to himself, but I can't coerce my feelings. If I love Sonya, that feeling is for me stronger and higher than all else. Nicholas did not go to Moscow, and the Countess did not renew the conversation with him about marriage. She saw with sorrow, and sometimes with exasperation, symptoms of a growing attachment between her son and the portionless Sonya. Though she blamed herself for it, she could not refrain from grumbling at and worrying Sonya, often pulling her up without reason, addressing her stiffly as my dear, and using the formal you instead of the intimate thou in speaking to her. The kind-hearted Countess was the more vexed with Sonya because that poor, dark-eyed niece of hers was so meek, so kind, so devotedly grateful to her benefactors, and so faithfully, unchangingly, and unselfishly in love with Nicholas, that there were no grounds for finding fault with her. Nicholas was spending the last of his leave at home, and a fourth letter had come from Prince Andrew from Rome, in which he wrote that he would have been on his way back to Russia long ago had not his wound unexpectedly reopened in the warm climate, which obliged him to defer his return until the beginning of the new year. Natasha was still as much in love with her betrothed, found the same comfort in that love, and was still as ready to throw herself into all the pleasures of life as before. But, at the end of the fourth month of their separation, she began to have fits of depression, which she could not master. She felt sorry for herself, sorry that she was being wasted all this time and of no use to anyone, while she felt herself so capable of loving and being loved. Things were not cheerful in the Rostovs' home. All right, there we have it, another chapter down. And it seems like it's up to Nikolai to save the Rostov family. But it doesn't look likely that he's going to actually do it. I found this really interesting. I never actually suspected that Nikolai being married would be the thing that could save the family from financial ruin. I suppose it makes sense. It's really not a common, well, as far as I know, it's not a modern thing to think of marriage as a tool for extracting money out of people, but maybe I'm not that familiar with marriage, so maybe it is. But I guess back then it was almost primarily that. Marriages were like business arrangements. Sonic Vroom said, Nicholas claims to be in love with Sonya, but we haven't seen him interact with her since returning. Maybe he's holding off until the family is well again. He was hesitant to return home, but is greatly enjoying himself, what with the hunting, uncle, Natasha's company, and all the familiarities between. Biscuit Potter responded, saying, I've also noticed he hasn't actually made a declarative statement about loving Sonya. It's always, maybe I do love a poor girl, or if I love Sonya, my feeling is stronger and higher than everything. I don't think he actually does love her. I think he just feels like he's supposed to, so he's kind of operating under the assumption that he does. That's a pretty good way to sum it up. I feel the same way. I've kind of sensed the same thing when you compare Prince Andrei and his feelings towards Natasha. It's almost like nothing would stop him from marrying Natasha. It's just happening. And when you really love someone, it's like you make excuses to make it happen, sort of thing. Like if you want it to happen, you'll make it happen. Whereas Nikolai is sort of umming and ahhing, and he's looking for excuses not to, and he's not sure. It doesn't feel quite the same. Kansas 57 said, "The Countess seems to know that ruin will come to her family, yet is doing nothing to change her way of life to ensure that it doesn't happen. Do you think that the Rostov children are as aware of this coming financial ruin, and how do you think it will affect them emotionally?" Sonic Vroom responded saying, "Natasha and Nicholas have noticed their parents' unease, but they might not have connected it with the financial situation. Had Nicholas known the extent of the debt, he probably would have consented to marry Julie. Well, now he knows the name of it because his mother has confided in him the reason he's trying to push him towards Julie. So his mother has basically all but told him, 'We need you to marry this girl as a matter of last resort.' And I guess as a first response, it hadn't quite dropped. The penny hadn't quite dropped to him how serious that was. And he kind of said, 'Oh, you know, what if I want to marry for love rather than money?' So I think when he's responded, he hasn't really considered yet how serious the situation must be in order for his mother to ask that. But I think he'll sort of piece it together from here pretty quickly." Kansas 57 also asked, "Why does everyone seem to give leniency to the Count? We have proof that he's bad at managing affairs. He loses hundreds daily to his neighbours in playing cards, to which he is clearly not adept. And yet, it was not the Count's fault. He could not help being what he was." Sonic Vroom answered this one saying, "The simile about the net really does define the Count's actions. He won't acknowledge his position or that it's largely his fault. I think he can't accept a different lifestyle. As I see it, he's always been ready to support or excuse people. Maybe that's why nobody's confronted the Count or capped his spending. They enjoy his generosity and parties." Yeah, it's kind of one of those people where he's got a good heart, but he's got his head in the sand. And he's not greedy. He's sort of, like, he's bad with money, but not in a greedy way. He's actually in a generous way. So you can see why people kind of have this leniency with him. Like, you know, he just loves to spoil people and live the good life and share what he has with everybody. But he is sending the family, you know, down the gurgler, so to speak, as my dad would say. So you can lay quite a lot of fault at his feet, and when things go pear-shaped, which I'm sure they're going to for the Rostovs, the blame can be basically attributed to old man Rostov. Anyway, that's going to do us for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.